Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Gabrielle used to ask me, Mom, why is it so important for you that as soon as we get the time here as permanent residents, we turn into citizens? And my reason was what I told him. You know that if a Dominican person disappears in, let's say, South Africa, China, whatever, that person disappears and vanishes forever. But if an American resident or a citizen disappears anywhere in the world, the government takes care. The government will be on top of that. And you see, this happens. And as I told you, I've been trying to reach the consular sections from the Dominican Republic here, trying to ask for help. And they haven't answered me back. Nobody has paid attention to this. This is like nothing has happened. I have even tried to reach reporters from Dominican Republic because I know that we have many TV shows and stuff that are seen here in the States, and the Dominican community and the Latin community sees the shows. They pay attention to situations like this. You know, it's been really disappointing seeing that my son's disappearance has been like nothing. Like, he didn't even was here in this world. Probably that if he killed himself, the body will have shown by now. But I know also people who disappear and die and are never found. You know how it is. The imagination roams wild when you don't know what could have happened. It's the worst part.
On February 22nd, 2018, 20-year-old Gabriel Cordova Tejada disappeared from his home in St. Petersburg, Florida. His mother, Angela, and brother Carlos later came home and realized that he was missing. They thought it was strange that he had left his phone and wallet behind. Next to the phone was a note with numbers written on it. Those numbers were the passcode to Gabriel's phone. They typed in the code and found a note indicating that Gabriel was leaving and had intended to harm himself. They immediately called the police, but no trace of Gabriel has ever been found. Gabriel's family has spent the past 9 months searching, without finding a single clue beyond that note that was left on his phone. But they're desperate for answers. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 150 of The Vanished, Gabriel Cordova Tejada's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Nearly 6 years ago, Gabriel, his mother, and his brother left their home and family in the Dominican Republic to start over on the Gulf Coast of Florida. His mom, Angela, worked for the State Department at the American Embassy in Santo Domingo, and in exchange for her dedicated service, was given green cards for her and her children. She shared that she never had any intention or desire to immigrate to the United States, but with two adolescent boys at home and increasing violence in the Dominican Republic, she made the difficult decision to emigrate to the U.S. Now, only a few years after uprooting their lives and moving to Florida, Angela and her son Carlos find themselves living a nightmare they believed they had fled. The nightmare of having someone go missing. We spoke with Angela for this episode, and she shared with us what the change was like for her family and how she came to the decision to move to the United States.
The corruption is the main thing. Unless you're part of the government machine in there that is really corrupt, you cannot succeed. It's not like it was the generation of my parents. With honest work, you could succeed, have a car, have a house, save for your retirement. And right now, if you're not on the, how we call it, the government train, you're not part of anything. And it's really a bad situation. That's one of the reasons why I left, because it was just choosing between having my kids involved in that kind of life or coming here and knowing that they could take their chance with honest work. I was never thinking of coming to live here. We have a very stable situation. The embassy job, I love it and I wanted to be there. But as I told you, the delinquency and the corruption in the Dominican Republic was getting worse and worse. Let me just tell you one thing that was the last drop on the glass of water that made me decide. Gabby and Emilio, they were 14 and 15 when I decided to come here. And they were almost graduating from high school and going to college. And at that time, the police in Dominican Republic started, they are doing raids at night and taking any car of any student coming out of any college and kidnapping people, asking for money. If the family didn't offer ransom, I knew of a case that was publicized by a news show in there that they raped two girls and two boys and asked the family for ransom. And I was like, oh no, my God, I'm not going to be able to sleep anymore as soon as these guys start college. And that was the last straw. I said, no, I need to take them out of here. I cannot risk my voice too. So I've been regretting a lot leaving my lifestyle, my family, my job. I decided to do the moving for them because when I came here, I was already 50. I just turned 50. I was like, oh my God, starting a new life at this age is really tough. But my voice was young, you know, it was the perfect age for both of them. And they adapted so, so well and so, so easily.
As you've probably heard in the news, immigration to the United States is a very difficult and lengthy process. Angela shared what the process was like for her family and why it was relatively easy.
We work for a certain time at the embassy. We are granted the residency after 20 years. It's the policy, at least in Dominican Republic, because I know in other places it's shorter. But after 20 years, we can apply for the residency, and we are granted that. It's very easy. It's a very short process.
We know that Gabriel and his family had immigrated to the United States several years prior to his disappearance. Angela told us a bit more about their life back home.
I work at the American Embassy over there in the financial section for over 22 years. And my kids were in the same on La Salle High School since they were in kindergarten. So they had a whole circle of friends that grew up with them, the same teachers, it's the same school that I graduated from. So I can tell you that we had a very stable family circle and family friend growing up. A lot of support, even if I'm a single mom and I grew them by myself. So they had a very stable life before they came here. We cut everything to come and live on the States because the situation in the Dominican Republic is getting very scary with the delinquency and the drug trafficking and stuff. I decided for them was better to come to a place where I knew that being honest and good workers, they could, you know, have a good life and live well without having the fear of losing their life to anything. I can tell you that we have been lucky. We came here. I just found a job a few months after I came here. I've been there for over 5 years. And the kids, they have been doing very well with school and everything. We left a lot of people, a big family over there, but we also came together. And that was really important for us that Gabriel, Emilio, and me were together.
Angela also has an older son, Mario, who had immigrated to the U.S. before them. He was living in New York with his wife and children, but after Angela moved to Florida with Gabriel and Carlos, they too made the move. The whole family was together again and spent much of their free time with each other. Gabriel enjoyed having the opportunity to spend time with his brother's young children. Most of us can remember a time in our childhood that we moved or changed schools and how it felt being the new kid. But at just 15 years old, Gabriel started an entirely new life in a different country with a different language, customs, and culture. Angela shared more about Gabriel's personality and that she shared an especially close relationship with her sons, so much so that they often wanted to spend their free time with her.
Well, Gabby, I can tell you, he was a very shy person. He mostly kept to himself, but I cannot tell you that he was a trouble guy or my sons. This is something that I can say, and I'm very proud of them. They have never given me headaches like drinking or using drugs or having any issue with bad friends, with troubles or anything. Gabby was very to himself and the family. Normally what we did was get out to his older brother family's house to be with the kids or go to the movies, go out with me and his younger brother shopping or having dinner and stuff. I was actually, normally I was trying to tell them, hey, you're Latin. You have to go out, go to the beach, go to the movies with your friends. No, he preferred to be with the family and do things with us. He didn't have, like, I can say, wow, what a social life.
We also spoke with Gabriel's brother, Carlos Emilio, for this episode. You'll hear Angela sometimes refer to him as Carlos and other times as Emilio. He is Gabriel's younger brother, and they're less than 2 years apart. He spoke to us about his relationship with Gabriel. He said they were very close when they were little. The two often watched television and played video games together at home. But because they were 2 years apart in school, they didn't share the same circle of friends. Carlos also spoke about adjusting to life here and felt that it was easier for him than it was for Gabriel because he was younger and had more time to create friendships at school.
I know he didn't make that many good friends at the beginning because he only had those the last 2 years of high school when we got here, and I came in here as a freshman, so I had all those years to make good friends and stuff like that, but he didn't get used to life here as quickly as I did. And in college, he was doing good, I think. I know he had a few friends, but no one really as close as the friends had as we had in Santo Domingo.
At the time of his disappearance, Gabriel was a student at the Tampa campus of the University of South Florida, where he was majoring in mechanical engineering. He had also worked in the student business services office on campus. There's an article about his disappearance online that was published by his school newspaper. In the article, his supervisor spoke about how Gabriel was such a wonderful person with a great work ethic. Angela told us more about Gabriel's time at USF and what his plans were after college.
The last two semesters, he was working in student services, and he was very excited because it was a job regarding helping the students groups to do activities and stuff It was really a job that he liked a lot. And he dealt with all kinds of students. I mean, it's not only the engineering ones that were his group, but the whole university. So he liked it a lot. Regarding his career, he was very enthusiastic with all the engineering stuff. It was mechanical engineering he was doing, and he liked it very much. He wanted to finish and find something here close by to me, but as we were always talking about the future, I was aware that he said, well, Mom, whenever work opportunities show up, even if it's in Alaska, well, I will go there. You know, he was willing to do many things.
February 22nd, 2018 was supposed to be an ordinary day for the family. Angela went to work, Gabriel had a midterm exam, and Carlos went to school. Carlos was the first to arrive home and noticed that Gabriel wasn't there, but his belongings were. Carlos told us what happened when he got home that day.
Well, I went to school that day early in the morning, and when I got home from college, it was around at noon, and I found out the door was open. I didn't think that much about it, but into doing the normal stuff that I do, like getting my food ready and everything, I noticed his stuff was there, was here in the house, his cell phone, his backpack, everything. And it was weird because he was supposed to be in college, and he usually takes, everything with him.
So Carlos came home to find all of Gabriel's belongings were there, but there was no Gabriel. He wasn't immediately alarmed, but this was odd because Gabriel had that midterm exam, and he normally took everything with him, like his phone, wallet, and backpack. Carlos started making his lunch, but something didn't seem right. So he went back to Gabriel's phone to see if it was charged, and found that he had written down the passcode to the phone. When Carlos entered the passcode, a note popped up. A note that made them believe that Gabriel had left with the intention to harm himself. This is when they jumped into action and contacted the local police. Angela also spoke about what she remembers from that day.
He left me at work at 6:30, and then he was supposed to take my car and go to have an exam and stay the whole day in USF, in the Tampa campus. I went home at noon, and my younger son also. And we found that Gabriel left his phone, his keys, his wallet, his social security, his green card, everything at home. My car keys, the car in the parking lot. And in his phone, he left a note saying that he was going to do something horrible, that he didn't feel okay. He was feeling down, and what we did was immediately call the police and tell them that we thought Gabriel was suicidal. When the police came to my house, what they said to us was that Gabriel was over 18 years old. He was actually 20 at the moment he disappeared. And that because of his age, they had to wait 24 hours before they take any action. Anyways, they alert the patrols around the house, and supposedly they said everybody, but the police woman who came here, she was very helpful, at least telling us that due to the situation that they couldn't do anything because of his age, that what we could do the best was look on the media, Facebook, Instagram, whatever, and start asking for help with people who knew him and who could have seen him. We waited. Actually, most of my family and everybody lives in the Dominican Republic where we came from. So nobody could do anything because of the distance, you know? My friends at work, everybody was working, nobody saw anything, so
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. So after Gabriel left home sometime on the morning of the 22nd, his trail totally went cold. We can only guess that he left on foot, since he didn't take his mom's car and there's no record of him arranging any kind of ride. But the strange thing is that not a single witness has come forward claiming to have seen Gabriel that day, and no one has ever seen or heard from him since. Where he was planning to go still remains a mystery, and the complete lack of tips and leads has been a source of frustration for his family and law enforcement. When I was researching this case, I was shocked to find that there was almost no information about Gabriel on the internet. There seems to be almost zero press coverage or police involvement. So we asked Angela how she feels about law enforcement's investigation into Gabriel's disappearance.
To be honest, it was really disappointing for me that knowing how the law has so many resources and how many things could have been done from the beginning, they treated Gabriel's disappearance like with a formula. I mean, we're talking about human lives. We're talking about situations like a person that could be in danger. You cannot say, okay, the protocol is he disappeared, he's over 18, we're not going to look for him until 24 hours pass. That didn't even happen. It had more than 24 hours before they even pay attention to what was happening. And because we push, we show up at the police station and we're like, what is happening? Well, who's in charge? What, you know, in his case specifically. Come on, 20 years is still not, I'm not telling you it's a kid, but it's just a young, inexperienced person. I think we have the chance to have done something if they were more proactive since we reported his disappearing. I think we could have saved him, or he left everything behind. I told you he left my car keys, his house keys, the wallet with his IDs, all the IDs, the passport, the debit card with his account that he has several thousand dollars in there, and the phone on top of the living room table. And he marked the password. So when his brother just got here a little bit before I did, He just saw the numbers and said, oh, what is this? He just marked the code and opened the phone. And the first thing that opened was the letter saying that he was going to do something. He described it like something that unthinkable, that nobody was ready for that, but that he felt so bad about himself and whatever. It was something unbelievable coming from him. They took the phone, they took his computer, they have checked everything, and they haven't found anything like that can give them an idea, okay, he was in contact with this person, or no, not even the only call he had that day. I told you he had an exam at USF, and one of his friends called him, and Gabriel, what's happening? The exam is going on, and you're not here. What's going on? It was the only message we found. But nothing alarming that you can say, oh, he was in contact with these weird people, or, you know, no information at all that can be alarming that can say that Gabriel was in bad places, to tell you that, or doing something wrong.
Angela also shared her frustrations with the seemingly constant cycle of new detectives assigned to Gabriel's case.
You know that I have been giving them their space, because one of the first things that they told me was not them, but people. They just told me, don't call them too much. You're pressuring them. You're antagonizing them. So leave them their space. I didn't call them since May. They came here to have my DNA and Emilio's DNA taken, to compare with anything that shows up, anybody or whatever remains they could find. And I just got in touch with them yesterday. You won't believe it. And when I called them, they just told me that they just changed the detective in charge. I wasn't even informed. I didn't know. They changed the detective that was assigned to our case was moved to another department, so I have a new one. And I just knew yesterday because I'd call, and then they said, oh, we're going to tell him to call you back. Unbelievable. So I cannot say they have been very proactive.
Even though there are various theories you could consider about what may have happened to Gabriel, after finding that note on his phone, Angela believes that it's likely that he may have harmed himself. Gabriel had shown signs of depression, and Angela believes he may have had bipolar disorder, since there's a history of that on his father's side of the family. From the outside, things seemed to be going well for Gabriel. He was going to school on a scholarship and had great grades. In the time leading up to his disappearance, Angela had been sick with the flu, and she thinks that may have caused her to overlook some warning signs that now, in hindsight, she can see much more clearly.
So I cannot say that Gabriel was struggling or having issues, except for the part that he was depressed from time to time, and I think it was the main issue. We actually didn't notice that he was getting like a little quiet and very to himself on the weeks before his disappearance. We think that what happened was that his depression just triggered. He hasn't had any real issue, and that's why he wasn't even taking any medication. He went into a depression mode without we even noticed that he was going into. I know that he was very quiet lately, the weeks before he disappeared. But I never knew that the thing was so serious until I saw the letter, you know, that saying that he was going to do something.
Leading up to February 22nd, Gabriel had been spending more time alone in his room. And the day before, he and Angela had even gotten into a bit of an argument about it.
The day before, yeah, we have an argument because he was locking himself in the room and not coming out. And he was supposed to be helping. We were organizing the house and stuff. And I argued with him and I told him, Gabriel, no, I need you to wake up and do something, you know, because he was going just Tuesdays and Thursdays to school. And the other days he stayed home sleeping. It was probably because I was sick myself with the flu. on those days, I didn't pay more attention to that. That was a symptom that he was really, I mean, nobody sleeps the whole day for 4 days, you understand? To be honest, I overlooked how serious it was. If I am honest, I think he took his life. Because, you know, I have heard so many theories about that. They have a separate life than what they have at the with the family when they are at college. He was at USF 2 days a week. Previously, in the year before, he was 5 days a week, almost the whole day, till let's say 7 to 7, working, doing his stuff. And it was his time, his personal time, his friends, his space. I cannot tell you that, oh, yes, I know which all the groups that he got together with or whatever. But after this year started, he was just going twice a week for, well, almost 12 hours, six to seven at night, twice a week.
People have proposed other theories to Angela, like the possibility that Gabriel just walked away to start a new life. In her heart, she feels as though Gabriel did take his own life, but for Angela, the not knowing has been incredibly difficult.
Sounds cruel, but what I tell the police and what I tell everybody is that I'd rather have a dead body, his bones, whatever is left, than not knowing or dying without knowing what happened with Gabriel. I'd rather have his body. Because it's horrible just thinking or, you know, how it is. The imagination runs wild when you don't know what could have happened. Even if I told you that my heart tells me that he's not here anymore, but I need to know for sure.
I reached out to the St. Petersburg Police Department to see what they've done to help locate Gabriel. I spoke to Detective Colin Brooks. Detective Brooks is an officer with St. Petersburg's Special Victims Unit. I asked him to explain what his department does.
Part of their duties are to investigate adult missing persons and also missing children as well. We've worked from people, obviously, with Alzheimer's that end up walking off, or anyone that is a family member hasn't heard from them in however long, a day to, you know, 2 weeks, doesn't really have a time frame. Usually, if a family member or friend feels that something went wrong and this person is missing, they contact the police and make a report. In certain cases with college-age kids, as I believe Gabriel was, from 18 to, I believe it's 26, falls under what's called Suzanne's Law, where you kind of investigate and make sure that there's no foul play or anything of that nature as well. So that's those are a little bit more heightened, along with the Alzheimer's folks who are older that end up walking off and are confused and don't know where they're at. We investigate pretty much all of the missing persons, but those are the two main ones that are, you know, get a little bit more attention.
Gabriel was 20 years old at the time of his disappearance, so his case falls under the provisions of Suzanne's Law, the one that Detective Brooks just mentioned. He explained what his department has done to look for Gabriel.
When I was advised of the case, I contacted the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office and had the helicopter fly over the area to see if they can see anything. We contacted Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office to assist with a bloodhound that we had come out. I had officers in the area showing pictures around through all the businesses, anything where anyone could be to might have seen Gabriel. Also checked video cameras in the area and things of that nature. I have never gotten any tips of anything that anybody actually saw. There are a lot of business, but there are some wooded areas as well. It's close to the water as well. In our area, we are on a peninsula in Pinellas County, so we have water on three sides. And where Gabriel lived, he is actually close to Tampa Bay, which is the bay in the area. Not too far from that, there are a lot of what called mangroves, and which are, to be clear, I don't know how to really describe them. They're trees and things that grow out of the water on the shore. There are those. We do have some little wooded areas scattered around, especially that area, but not huge wooded areas. and we're very flat terrain. And on the other side, there's beaches on the other side, which is the ocean side. So you have the Gulf of Mexico on one side of our county, and then Tampa Bay, which is the on the other side of the county. But there are a lot of businesses there and people, yes. Pinellas County is one of, I believe, the most populated county in Florida. Obviously, if we get any information that points us anywhere, we will definitely look into any information that we are given. But at this point, I don't even have a direction of travel that he went.
Detective Brooks spoke about the note that was on Gabriel's phone.
I mean, I can tell you that a suicide note was left. I don't really want to get into that as well either, just for their aspect of it, but I will say that a note was left that indicated that.
The detective also shared that he only recalls one tip or lead ever coming in regarding Gabriel's case.
The only really tip that I can remember getting was someone called in and said to check the mental hospitals in Sarasota, or the county south of us, which of course I did, but nothing ever came of that. But that's really the only tip that I really remember coming in. A lot of time we use social media a lot, in which I use this as well for this case as well, putting it on Facebook and things of that nature. And we usually do get, once it's on Facebook, usually we get tips and people said they've seen them. So actually, yeah, with this one, we didn't get any of that off of Facebook. We usually get a pretty good record using Facebook and getting the information out through Facebook. But this one, there just wasn't much.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices in premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. Angela wanted to share Gabriel's story because she wants to find him, but she also feels as though she missed some warning signs before his disappearance. She hopes that by spreading his story, others will be more aware, and that maybe someone else can avoid this nightmare that she's been living. Suicide is a topic that we often avoid talking about. In recent years, this has started to change a bit with the deaths of some celebrities like Robin Williams and Anthony Bourdain, among many others. I wanted to talk to an expert to learn what drives suicidal behavior and what we can learn to help those around us who are hurting. I spoke to Dr. Julie Serrell, a licensed clinical psychologist and professor at the University of Kentucky. She's currently the president of the American Association of Suicidology and has spent much of her career focusing her research on survivors of suicide and suicide prevention. I gave Dr. Serrell a brief overview of what I had learned about Gabriel. This is what she shared about missing persons cases that may involve suicide.
In the case that you've described to me, we don't know what happened to him, but I'm sure his mom and his brother, and even you right now, have some images. And if there's more evidence about what truly did happen to him, those images become more and more traumatic as they're thought through again and again and kind of relived. And I think that happens a lot of the time for suicide as well as other families that have reported someone missing. It's this sense of not knowing. And sometimes that's worse for people than having a finite closure because they continue to have those what ifs. And there's a slight glimmer of hope that they realize probably isn't true, but they can't move on with their lives in any way because it might be true. And so they don't want to put that finality on my loved one is really gone. But at the same time, that's what they realize. There's this idea in bereavement work of meaning making, which is kind of trying to figure out, instead of getting stuck in mourning or what I could have done or what went wrong, is making meaning of the relationship and the time that you had together. And so if someone feels like, well, there's a tiny hope they might still be out there, we might be able to reconcile or we might be able to see them again, it kind of makes it really much more difficult for that grief to occur and for people to kind of start making some meaning of the life and the loss and start to move on.
Earlier, you heard Angela and Carlos describe the note that Gabriel left behind. I thought those types of notes were relatively common in cases where someone plans to harm themselves, but Dr. Serrell taught me something I didn't know.
I think one of the things that you mentioned that I think is of interest is suicide notes. It's actually uncommon for people to leave suicide notes. With people having access to their phones all the time and the internet, it's becoming a little more common that people leave final messages. But overall, across time in the U.S., less than 20% of people that died by suicide leave a suicide note or a final communication.
I also learned that there are many misconceptions about suicide notes and how society and law enforcement perceive cases that don't have one.
And there's a trope, actually, on TV that really annoys me. Oh, there's no note. It couldn't have been a suicide. It must have been something else. But the reality is that most suicides don't end with someone leaving a note. And even when there is a note, what we found is that the note doesn't do everything that family members hope for when they hope for a note. That notes typically kind of explain those last minutes in someone's life, the amount of hopelessness or the pain they're feeling. And they often have instructions for the days after the death. So this is who should have my pets. This is who should have my possessions. But they don't really talk to the underlying meaning. And that's what people really want. Oh, what could I have done? How could I have stopped this? And notes, usually people aren't organized enough in their thinking when they're in that much pain to really be able to describe what led up to that very moment in their lives.
One of the most important things I wanted to learn was what those who are managing suicidal ideations are dealing with and how families and friends can help.
So I think that evolutionarily, we're really designed to keep ourselves alive. And so when someone is feeling suicidal, there's something that's not right. And it's really despite the fact that when people are suicidal, they really feel like they don't deserve help from others, they don't belong, that people would even be better off without them. And I think that's one of our issues as a society with people who are suicidal, because we can look at them. You know, you look at your friend and you're like, of course it can get better. You have all these amazing traits and, you know, there's a reason you're my friend. But when someone is suicidal, their thinking just can't get past the fact that they are a burden, they don't belong. That it's important to realize that you can get help and there's lots of places to get help. And one of the things that I suggest is that everybody, even if you've never been suicidal, or if you have and you're at a place where you're not anymore, creates a safety plan. Something that reminds you in those deepest, darkest moments who the people are you really can rely on, what you can do to distract yourself, even if it's something kind of frivolous for a few minutes. That's a few minutes where you're out of pain a little bit, and where you can get help, how you can calm yourself, what kinds of things are relaxing or distracting to you.
Angela and Carlos are in a tough spot because they believe that Gabriel took his own life, but they aren't certain. They're stuck in that place where they have a missing person and they want to find them, but they're also dealing with the grief of losing someone to suicide. Dr. Serrell shared her experiences working with families who have lost a loved one to suicide.
And it's hard for those of us who are not suicidal to understand, because we can see thousands of options sometimes, like, oh, you could just do this, or you could do this, or you could get help. But that's the thing about suicidal thinking, is it really kind of constricts people's ability to see past the pain they're currently in. And it becomes really frustrating for those of us who are trying to help. For many families, a suicide is very similar in many ways to any other kind of sudden traumatic loss. So when their loved one has been murdered or died in a car crash unexpectedly, suicides can be very similar. The thing that's different about suicide is the constant questioning and the wondering why, or what if, or if only. So oftentimes people wonder, if only I'd done something different, then I could have changed the course. Or why were they feeling this way? They were starting to feel better, like in this case. And so I think many people kind of on the surface think that there isn't a lot of difference, because when we look at studies over time, family members who have lost someone to suicide don't look that much different on pretty standard measures than people who lost loved ones to sudden traumatic loss. But there's these qualitative differences that really remain so much for people who are bereaved by suicide.
Dr. Serrell also spoke about how the stigma and language around suicide is changing, and that these behaviors often can run in families, as we heard Angela discuss Gabriel's family's struggle with depression and bipolar disorder.
We don't typically use the word commit. I don't use the word commit because I've worked with so many families who've lost loved ones to suicide, and many of them say to me that the word commit really conjures up a crime or a sin. And so when they hear that word commit, they kind of crush into themselves. So I tend to say died by suicide and follow those kinds of language guidelines. But it is more common that suicide runs in families, and there's a couple reasons why. One is there's some genetic evidence that the genes for suicidal behavior, which are separate from the genes from things like depression, tend to run in families. So it's not one gene, and it's pretty complicated, but there is a little bit of genetic expression going on with suicide running in families. The thing I think that's more salient is a lot of the times for people who have lost a loved one, not just a family member, to suicide, is that it kind of opens a door that wasn't there before for them, and it makes suicide a possibility. So we often hear from people who have been, and I use the term exposed to the suicide of someone they're close to. They know someone who's died by suicide, and for the first time in their life, perhaps, they start thinking about suicide. And it's this weird conundrum, because they have experienced this pain that is unimaginable, having lost someone they care about to suicide, and they would never, ever wish that pain on somebody else. But at the same time, they start thinking, well, if they use that in his escape, maybe I could as well.
I also wanted to know how many families are exposed to suicide and what the implications of this data are.
I think it's super important to talk about suicide because it occurs. It's a top 10 cause of death in the U.S. We lose almost 45,000 Americans every year. We actually lose more people to suicide than to breast cancer these days. Used to be different, but we've spent a lot of money doing amazing research to keep people who are diagnosed with breast cancer alive. And a lot of that is that they're out there raising money, wearing pink, buying things in the grocery that are pink, and there's been a ton of money for research. The same hasn't happened in suicide. We don't talk about it. We hope it goes away, and the numbers just keep going up. The numbers have really steadily risen over the past two decades. So for the longest time, I was trying to really figure out what is the trajectory of bereavement, who's affected most, and was pushed back saying, well, it's just grief. And so I kind of started at a place that was much further upstream and said, okay, well, let's just see if we can define this population. How many people are exposed to suicide? And so what we've done is in a series of random digit dial studies and door-to-door studies, we've looked at how many Americans know someone who's died by suicide, what we refer to as exposure. And time again, what we find is with studies of adults, about 50 to 60% of American adults know someone who's died by suicide. And about a third of those people are close to someone, at least one person who's died by suicide. So when we look at the magnitude of this population, it's quite large. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about specialized populations where suicide might occur at higher rates or at different rates. So as far as I know, there's nothing on prisoners. There's nothing on people of color or people who are Hispanic or Latino. Right now, we're doing some work with Trans Lifeline. So we're looking at exposure to suicide in trans adults. And then we're also looking at different worker groups who might have exposure to suicide on the job. So things like law enforcement officers on average respond to about 30 suicide scenes over the course of their careers. And now we're looking at other professions, mental health professions, other first responders, crisis workers, physicians who might routinely encounter suicide.
I couldn't stop thinking about the cases that I've covered that we've since learned most likely died by suicide. These people and their loved ones weigh heavily on me. So I wanted to take the opportunity to ask Dr. Serrell what drives someone to believe that there is no alternative.
One of the leading theories of suicide right now is the interpersonal theory of suicide, which was developed by Thomas Joyner and colleagues. And essentially what it says is that the ideal conditions for someone to end their life involve three different things. One of them is this sense of thwarted belongingness. Even if they live with someone like their mother and their brother, they feel like they're alone. They don't belong anymore, that other people wouldn't understand or care for them. The next is this feeling of being a burden. So not only are they alone, but other people's lives are worse because of them. So even if his mother and brother cared about him so much, wanted to keep him safe and alive, people that are suicidal often think that people would be better off without them. And it's distorted thinking. It's not reality, but they genuinely believe that their death will bring about some relief or even happiness to those left behind. And then the third thing that is necessary in this theory for people to die by suicide is having what's referred to as acquired capacity or acquired capability. The idea that they have to have engaged in behaviors that help them get past this evolutionarily imprinted idea that we have to keep ourselves alive. And so that is use of self-harm or suicide attempts in the past, doing things like shooting guns or being a surgeon where you kind of are taught to actually cut into someone, or use of substances that kind of lower your inhibitions about staying alive.
We don't know exactly why Gabriel was feeling depressed and struggling. But I was curious to know how Dr. Serrell believes technology, the internet, and the constant pressure to be in communication have impacted suicidal behaviors.
So I think one of the really positive things about the internet is it makes people who might be marginalized less isolated. So for the gay kid who thinks there's nobody else like them in a rural community, the internet is an amazing place to realize that they're not alone and there's other people having very similar experiences. The other side to it is that people can be quite cruel and not see that there's somebody on the other side of the screen and make statements that are flippant or mean about suicide or people who are acting suicidal or saying they're suicidal. So that kind of cyberbullying is real and happens. And then the other part of that is people are exposed to suicide and suicidal behavior, I think, at a much higher rate than in the past. Someone can sit and watch 13 Reasons Why alone on their phone and see that incredible amount of kind of visceral gore that happened dramatically in that show. and not have the context for the amount of pain that those suicides leave in the person left behind. I feel like the TV shows that really dramatize suicide have not done it in a way that helps people, but rather gives us these kind of overly detailed images that then cannot leave our mind of what suicide attempts might look like, what suicide might look like. There's no reason to show someone's suicide attempt or to have a news program talk about what color scarf someone might have been wearing when they died by suicide. Those kinds of details, I think, can traumatize people who might have been suicidal or might have been thinking about methods. And they can also be very traumatic for loved ones who envision the suicide of the person they cared about from similar methods and now have more details to fill out that image. You know, having discovered someone, even if you barely knew them, that's a trauma. And we don't acknowledge that these experiences are traumatic. So the people that discover people that have died by suicide, as well as family members that never saw the body but have that image of the method and what might have happened, experience lots of difficulties that are very similar to what's described as post-traumatic stress. They have nightmares, they have flashbacks, they have re-experiencing, they're kind of always on edge for some of them, because this is the kind of trauma that the PTSD diagnosis was created for.
So what happened to Gabriel on February 22nd, 2018? We know his family believes that he harmed himself, and the note that he left behind on his phone certainly does suggest that those were his intentions. The fact that he's still missing has left his family wondering about those other possibilities as well. Could he have decided to just walk off and start over somewhere else? Since there's been no trace of Gabriel since he left home on February 22nd, we can't be certain. You heard Detective Brooks speak about how they don't even know where to look because they don't even know what direction Gabriel went. No one remembers seeing him, and they couldn't find him on any surveillance videos. According to Angela, the police didn't really want to do anything for at least 24 hours because Gabriel was over 18. You also heard Detective Brooks talk about how they respond quickly to Alzheimer's patients who go missing. Years ago, my grandfather had Alzheimer's and went missing. I appreciated the rapid response. They found him alive, but he was trapped at the bottom of a ravine. Without that rapid response, he may have perished overnight. I struggle to understand how someone who is obviously in distress, like Gabriel, who had left a note, why he didn't get that rapid response. As Angela said, this is a human life. This is her son. Maybe they could have found him in time to intervene, in time to get him some help. For Gabriel's family, this is just one of the many what-ifs that they're left trying to reconcile. If you have any information about the disappearance of Gabriel Cordova Tejada, please contact the St. Petersburg Police Department at 727-893-7780. At the time of his disappearance, Gabriel was 20 years old, between 5'8 and 5'10 inches tall, and weighed approximately 165 pounds. He has brown hair and brown eyes. You can follow Gabriel's case on Facebook at Help Find Gabriel Cordova Tejada. If you're feeling hopeless or like you may engage in self-harm, please consider contacting the National Suicide Prevention Line at 1-800-273-8255 or send a text message to 741-741.
Life has so much to offer you that even if you think you're in a black hole, at some point you will get out of that and you will see how many wonderful things you can do. It's worth it just to hang on. It's not how much you love them, it's their state of mind. Is there something that probably you think you could have done that? In my heart, as a mom, I know that he's gone. But you cannot stop hoping, well, he may be somewhere. Or thinking the worst. Some people got bothered because I mentioned in a TV interview that in this country, so many people disappear without a trace. But it's true. It happens a lot. I see cases in here that never get solved, that you never know what happened. And that was one of my biggest fears.
That brings us to the end of episode 150. I'd like to thank Angela, Carlos, Detective Brooks, and Dr. Serrell for taking the time to speak with us. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There's a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by filling out a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from Colorado. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.